Welcome to Jim Brown's Outrig Capercast. I'm Jim, and this is my ongoing collection of stories about modern seafaring watercraft and their people. Let's see, this is caper number 7? Yeah, I think I can keep track of the numbers without getting Christy in the act. But let me give you a little preamble about this one.
Now listen to me for once.
Uh-oh.
You've got to jump right into the story. Don't give me a bunch of who, what, when, and where. Kick it off with the very first thing about this caper that pops into your muddled mind.
Well, aside from the dinghy trying to climb the mast, which really does come later, that would be waking up in Scrimshaw. Heck, I never thought I would wake up in that boat again. I'd sold it 3 years previously to a guy who never used it. And after designing it and building it and sailing it for 40 years, I had, with a heavy heart, I'd given it up, you know. And here I was waking up in one of Scrimshaw's quarter berths. I guess it took a few seconds to realize where I was. It was still dark out, apparently well before dawn. And it might have taken a few more seconds for me to realize what had caused me to wake up. It was that faint, musical moaning of just the slightest breeze in the rigging. You know, that... We'd had a good breeze the day before, sailed all day to windward, and it had been a very quiet night anchored there in the lee of Sandy Key. It's just a big sandbar surrounded by a lot of shallow water and covered with brush and birds. And we couldn't get too close. There wasn't any real shelter. But it had been extremely still by sundown. But this pre-dawn zephyr made me think that we were going to have a good breeze again this coming day. So I must have drifted off again, and the next time I awoke, there was a bit of light in the sky and a fairly steady moan in the rigging. You know, that boat and I are really joined at the hip. And the shroud's chain plate comes down right past that bunk, and so you can really hear anything that's going on in the rig. And also in the water, Scrimshaw's hull above the waterline is only a quarter of an inch thick plywood. And so any water noise at all dancing around the waterline, you can hear. And the boat was bobbing just a little bit. But, you know, after all those many anchorages, I could tell that the wind wasn't enough to make white caps, and we were just, well, I was just lying there and loving it. I thought about waking Bruce and Joe so that we could get underway, but I found myself tripping out on the structure of the boat. I swear I can remember building every stick of that thing. I was really enjoying the little deck beams and the knees around the hatch and all the soot stains from the boys' kerosene lamps and then I noticed that there were a few gusts in the wind. The boat was definitely talking to me. Been such a quiet night, and now she was bouncing a bit in a little chop, and I thought, boy, we're going to have another thrashing slog to windward today. Or I wondered if the wind had changed. You can't really tell. We had anchored in very shallow water and very gushy bottom, you know, had a little trouble getting the anchor to hold. It seemed like everything was coated with weed. But after a bit more musing about all the memories in my old boat, this is a recent story, incidentally. It was just last April 2016. I noticed that the boat had stopped dancing in the chop. Even though the wind had increased, she was lying there steady as a rock. So I squirmed out of my bunk and took a quick peek outside and noticed that Sandy Key was nowhere near where she was supposed to be. And so I woke up Bruce. I said, "Hey, Bruce. The good news is that the boat is steady as a rock, but the bad news is that we are hard aground." Poor Bruce, he sat up and he said, What? I said, Bruce, the anchor has dragged. We are hard aground in a rising wind. We've got to get out of here. And he said, he rubbed his eyes. He said, can't we have breakfast first? Well, I had fits while trying to wriggle into my shorts, and I noticed that Joe was getting up. He was in the after cabin, and he wisely turned the radio on right away to the weather station, and it didn't take long for us to realize that they were giving the tides. It looked like maybe we had half an hour, 45 minutes before high tide. That meant the water was still coming. That meant we had a chance. So we went into action. Now, Joe got the anchor up. It came in with a bushel of weed, just choked with weed. And we put the motor and the rudder down. Scrimshaw has a retractable outboard motor and a deep kick-up rudder. We put them both down. The rudder would only go down part way. You know, Scrimshaw is a trimaran, so she'll float in only thigh-deep water, so the rudder was dragging on the bottom. Or so I thought. We got the motor running, opened the throttle. She was grunting away out there, and nothing happened. We all got out on one float to try to take some of the load off of the main hull. Nothing happened. It was clear the motor was not going to get us out of this predicament. So Bruce took charge. After all, it was his boat now. He had recently bought it from the guy who had only used it once in 3 years. We had just spent 10 days trying to clean her up. She'd been full of rats and bugs. And now here she was, stuck fast in the mud offshore of the Everglades, actually a long way from nowhere and nobody around.
All right, Jimmy, quit yakking about the boat. Tell us what happened for Pete's sake. Get into the now of it.
As a matter of fact, I was just going to shift into the present tense. But if you keep interrupting, I'm going to have to tell him about you. So anyway, Bruce hollers, hoist the main. So Joe and I get the main up. Of course, the boom is whipping around, but the sail is not flogging badly. It's a full batten sail.
There he goes again. See what I mean?
Come on, Christy. Boating people like stories that they can learn from. And, you know, the resistance to flogging is one of the few advantages of a full batten sail. Now, I should also talk about their disadvantages. But in deference to you, okay, I'll go on with the story. But if you keep interrupting, you know, it won't be long before the listeners figure out where you're coming from. So, Bruce sheets in the main. The boat starts to move. We all cheer. We're not stuck in the mud. But then he shouts, hey, I can't steer. And the boat turns right up into the wind, tacks itself, and drives right back into the mud. So now Bruce hollers, we've got to have some jib so I can steer with the sails. So I try to set the Genoa. Now, I've got to explain this, Christy, so hold your digital tongue for a minute. Scrimshaw has a large, heavy, roller furling and roller reefing Genoa, and it sets on a homemade, backyard-built furling device that has an open drum at its base. Now, the thing has functioned perfectly since I put it on there sometime, I guess, in the 80s. And yet, I've learned that when pulling out the Genoa, setting the Genoa, you have to keep a little strain on the furling line. As the sail comes out, the furling line gets reeled in. And if you don't hold a little load on it, it can get spun off the drum. Well, this trip sure taught me how much I had forgotten about how to operate my old boat, man. I went in there to set the Genoa and let the whole thing rip out fast, and the furling line ended up in a terrible tangle around the headstay turnbuckle, and now we had a real predicament on our hands. Without undoing that tangle, we were unable to roll the Genoa up to put it away. And furthermore, we were not even able to take it down. Because of the nature of the homemade device, there's no halyard, so cannot take the sail down. So both sails were flogging heavily now. Nobody knew what to do. We were just hanging on. The Genoa was threatening to destroy itself. It was shaking the boat so hard like a terrier shakes a rat. We had to do something, so we pulled in the Genoa sheet, got some wind in it, took the slack out of it, you know, quieted it down. The boat went peeling away to starboard and headed straight downwind, then jibed itself and tacked itself, and now the Genoa was flogging so hard, and it had plenty of slack in it, so the sheet tangled itself around one of the lifeline stanchions to the point it looked like a wasp's nest out there. So Joe bravely went out there to try to clear it. He had to climb around the dinghy, which was stowed out there on the side deck. The sheet was flailing dangerously. Joe got whapped in the face a couple of times, but he did manage to get the thing clear, and in the process of flailing around, the Genoa sheet got caught underneath the thwart in the dinghy, and the next thing we knew, the boat was tacking itself again, and the sheet was pulling the dinghy up onto the cabin top. For a moment there, it looked like the dinghy was literally trying to climb the mast. Well, I don't know how he did it, but Joe managed to get that thing loose and drag the dinghy back where it belonged. All of this while the boat goes corkscrewing off downwind, dragging a huge trail of mud in the water, tacking and jibing completely out of control. So while Joe struggles with the dinghy and Bruce struggles with the sheets and the helm, trying to figure out how to steer the boat with the sails, I'm trying to figure out how to clear that furling line. It seems it wouldn't be prudent to cut it, because then we couldn't roll the sail up for sure. Now, all of a sudden, Bruce leaves the cockpit, jumps up onto the foredeck, and hollers, "No more mud trail!" I look back, and sure as heck, the boat is still spinning donuts downwind, but there's no mud trail. We have miraculously dragged into deeper water. Bruce throws the anchor out, it bites the bottom, snaps the bow up into the wind, and Joe and I dive in to try to clear that furling line. Finally, I figure it has to come out of the cockpit. I ball it up in a tight coil, pass it to Joe, and he passes it round and around and around the headstay turnbuckle, and then winds it up on the drum around and around and around the other direction. We lead it back into the cockpit and haul on that baby, and finally put that Genoa to sleep. It's hard to understand why that thing hadn't completely destroyed itself, but it always was a very heavy sail to withstand the stress of being rolled up part way when reefed in very hard winds. Anyway, now we could sort of lick our wounds and get organized. Joe had taken a nasty lashing from that Genoa sheet, but I stepped back to have a look at the rudder, which, incidentally, you cannot see from the cockpit. And I realized, to my horror, that I had caused the whole fiasco. My eyesight has declined to the point where I've got no business in a boat, man. I had confused the rudder uphaul with the rudder downhaul, so that the rudder had been barely touching the water during this escapade. Of course, I was mortified, was trying to apologize. And Bruce admitted that he was wondering how we were ever going to get out of there. There was no real danger to life and limb, but...
Oh, yeah? You forgot to tell them about the shark.
Oh, right. She's good for something. Yeah, it was back when we were trying to motor off of the mud. And I said, "Hey, that's okay, fellas. We've done this many times before. If a couple of us just step over the side and push, we'll be able to push her off of the mud." And Joe looked back and he said, "Not now, not now, look at that." And even I could see it. And there was a, I don't know, a 5-foot shark cruising in our mud trail. Both its dorsal and its tail were up out of the water. It was, just another very fortunate thing. Our real luck was that there were no obstructions. We didn't run into a rock or a wreck or anything out there that damaged the boat. We never once heard, a knock or a grinding sound out of her. It was, you know, this whole thing happened in a bed of snow. And after all that, we were able to get the rudder all the way down and get some coffee and find our way out of the shallows and continue our voyage. It was a feeling of tremendous relief. Well, maybe you can tell I love to tell these stories, and I hope you've enjoyed this one. Maybe next time you come, we can put this one together with some other anchoring capers, and in the end, maybe learn something about anchoring.
Hey, folks. He says there is a shipwreck in the next caper, so I guess not all anchoring fiascos end up lucky. Incidentally, he's got a book out about multi-hull safety. It's called The Case for the Cruising Trimaran. And he's got a memoir called Among the Multi-Hulls. They're available on Amazon. And there are a bunch of other related information products to see at his publisher's website, OutRigMedia.com. He does these audio capers so you can listen while doing something else, but if you have time to read or watch videos, check out his books and all the other OutRig stuff. Around here, I'll try to keep the geezer on story, but no promises.
Man, how'd you like to wake up with that every morning?